Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're off. We're all warm. Natalie was just about to tell us how warm she is, and Nathaniel's warm. I'm cold.
Yeah.
But I'm, guess I'm warm up, I suppose.
I'll tell you what I think it is with me, Nick. I think it's because I was just boasting, swanking to Natalie earlier that I've got behind me
a heated
clothes horse with heated rails. It's new. $49.99.
Well, it's so you're renovating your laundry room then?
Well, you know, just the other one basically collapsed. So we've replaced it with a new clothes horse, which has heated rails.
Okay, so it's a clothes horse with heated rails. But what that does is it dries your clothes quicker, right?
That's the idea, yeah.
I remember I used to have heated floors.
Oh, yeah.
David Trent used to visit. I mean, I am a mess. As humans go, I don't know. I struggle with daily things. And laundry is the absolute. I mean, you do it every day, right?
I love it every other day.
Laundry is the worst thing for me. And in actual fact, I've got a whole bunch of clothes, and I'll wash the clothes. I've got nowhere to put them. I've got no storage in my flat, which is part of what I've been sort of like aiming to sort of sort out. And so I will wash clothes, and then I will leave them in a pile, and then the pile will get moved round and round, and I just step over the pile of clothes because I've got nowhere to put the clothes. I'm just going to throw all my clothes out. I've bought myself a velour tracksuit, which I am going to wear every day. And when that gets dirty, I'm going to buy myself another velour tracksuit. I'm just going to wear velour tracksuits now.
It'd be like you're in Goodfellas. They have those, don't they, when they're relaxing at home?
Yeah, or a 90s Missy Elliott video. one of the two.
I think that's a good look for you. I think that's...
We'll see. I'm looking forward to it arriving. It was... But David Trent used to come and visit me in my old flat, which I rented, which was, thank God I don't live there now, because it would have never have been able to afford to live there. But I lived in this... basically, me and my girlfriend split up. I needed to move to my own flat. I was living at hers, so I had to find my own place. And my agent helped me, which was very good of her, which is beyond her job. And she found me... I think we did it all in one day. There was like 10 properties to look at in one area, and I did them all in one day. And it was something like the third place that I looked at, I was just like, right, I want to live in this place. And then I did all the others, and then I went back and looked at the third place again. I was just like, this is the place. Signed all the stuff, got it. And then it was like, this is the most expensive place in London to live. And why did you you know how much I make. why did you send me here? I'm going through a breakup. I can't look after myself. I've never had to do. And I ended up living in this place but it had this huge heated floor. And David Trent would come over, and I'd have done my laundry. And rather than hang it up, I would literally just throw it all on the floor, turn the heating on, and then leave the house. by the time I came back, my pants were warm. everything was dry.
I think a warm pair of pants off a radiator.
Or the floor.
Life's small.
Or the floor.
To be honest, if the pants are warm in my floor, I'd be worried. I wouldn't want to pick them up. I don't know. That feels wrong.
They were just, but I didn't lay them out flat. Well, I did. I got into a habit of laying everything down flat and just putting the heating on.
Jab it like it was a dead body, like you could make out a human shape.
No.
A top and some trousers.
No, it was like, yeah, but maybe it was like someone had fallen asleep in a bundle of clothes, just a pair of socks peeking out the bottom. But it's like this huge bundle of clothes in the middle of the floor, so half of them would be hot and the other half would still be wet.
You'd have to get the ones from the bottom. Be like you sort of try, like cooking, I suppose. You train.
No, but like half of the same pair of pants. You know, they were like camouflage only with damp.
Yeah, that's what Two-Face wears. I reckon he wears them.
He pisses some, half of his pants at
quite
night.
Nice, and there's some that are just a bit sort of claggy on his evil side. To piss him off.
Or his good side.
It's good. So depend on
because obviously, with a lot of evil people in this world. There are no repercussions. That's something to. I'm in such a. I'm in a bad mood.
Anyway, what's your name?
But my name's Nick. This is Nathaniel Metcalf. You're listening to Fan Size Family, Fan Size Fan Club. What? Is that right?
Something like that.
But we were talking about. So you've got a heated laundry rack. First rule of fan club, tell your friends. Second rule of fan club, tell your friends. For the love of God, just tell your friends. So you got a heated laundry rack.
Yesterday. And now I think it's on now. But I think now I've realised, I kept thinking, oh, it's a bit hot. I think it's also obviously heating the room as well.
Yes, well, that's it's heated.
It makes sense. But so I think it might be too hot. I might have to go and turn it off in a bit.
It works. So I, when I lived in Seven Sisters, I had no money, and then I had a lot of money, and now I'm in between. It's not Seven Sisters, but it's not the glory days of Uncle Heavy Entertainment loaded. Eat your heart out! Bang! 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 Now it's like
the foobar years.
These are the foobar years. These are the COVID/foobar years. But when I lived in Seven Sisters, there was no money, and we couldn't afford heating. So in terms of laundry, I've said it so many times, but I had one pair of trousers, and if the trousers got dirty, you would wash them. And cancel all of your plans. And then you'd let it drip dry on a cold radiator.
If it's on a cold radiator, you can put them anywhere.
Yeah, but it hangs on a radiator, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, you might. The anywhere that we've already established that is that it's in a ball on the floor. And unless it's a heated floor, what's the point in that? Yeah. You just get a wet carpet.
I tell you what, if they're not dry by winter, we'll put the heating on. How's that?
We couldn't afford the heating. We didn't. I don't even know if the heating worked. What we ended up doing, or what I ended up doing, and I can't. I've always had like this deep-seated fear of electric blankets.
I know what you mean.
I think the old ones were dangerous. You'd hear horror stories of people falling asleep with their electric blankets on. But I bought myself an electric sheet. And then what you did was you could sit in. This is 2008 or 9. You'd switch your electric sheet on, and you'd keep yourself warm in bed. Now you wouldn't need to heat the rest of your house. You could just literally heat your bed and keep warm that way. And now I'm in a position where I've got this flat which is very cold with huge windows. So, you know, it's it catches you by surprise because you're in bed and it's all very warm and then you come out of bed and then your whole house is absolutely freezing. It just makes you stay in bed for longer. But there's nothing to get up for except for, obviously, fan club once a week. Third week in a row I've been late in my own flat. But it's a different reason every time.
Okay.
But, you know, my parents have had the first jab.
Hey, that's good.
How about you?
My parents have had jab number one and I guess somewhere between 10 weeks away or something till they get their next one, I guess.
Yes. What does it mean for society?
In what regard?
Well, apparently everyone can still get COVID, right? Even if they've got the jab, they can pass it on. They just...
Oh, yeah, well, I think it reduces it, doesn't it? So I think it's meant to reduce it by some degree. But I guess no one knows at the minute, do they? Because it's like they're going, oh, well, we've done all these, you know, you keep hearing about how they're vaccinated. Is it 12 or 13 million people?
I said that, yeah, the vaccination against the South African strand is good for up to about 10%, and then it's just as bad.
I think it's more than that, isn't it?
I don't know. It's difficult to know. You go on the news, and that's what I heard off the news.
I think a lot of stuff on the news feels like a bit kind of they're drumming it up. All the sort of science people I've watched seem to be saying that it actually does quite a bit, or they don't actually know to what extent it does it. But it's like, you know, almost the thing is, you know, if everyone has it, then the transmission's going to lower anyway, so you're going to be far less likely to get it. And even if it doesn't, they'll just update the jab like they do the flu jab, so you could have another one in the autumn.
Right.
I think we're still on track. And I think a lot of that's the media getting a bit worried about it when it's probably all right.
Yeah, but it's weird that it's the media getting worried about it when it's the live press launch. You know, it's the live government update from Number 10. So that's not the press. That is just the news that is showing what is happening live.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of like, it's just weird, isn't it? Because it's like now everyone's getting the jabs. It's just like, right, are we gearing up to having to leave our houses again?
I think who knows? It might still be a long way off. It might actually be, I don't know, a year, less than a year.
When they say we have to leave our houses again, right? Is it optional?
I think for a lot of things it will be now. I think a lot of it's going to be people working from home if they can be. And it's a bit like, I think the Zoom thing works, right? They just go, like, do you want to come in for a meeting? Nah, can I just do this?
For meetings, yes. The only time it's brilliant having a meeting in person is when you want to go to FOP afterwards.
Mm. You go to your office?
You go to Soho, you find the place, and you have the meeting for another dream that's going to be thrown in a bin as soon as you leave their room. And then you get to FOP.
Yeah, and, that's true. What you don't want is you don't want a meeting at 10 and another one at 4:30 that are like round the corner from each other or anything.
Oh no, I like organising all my meetings. Bang, bang, bang. I'm free at Wednesday at 10. Oh, I'm free at Wednesday at 12. Oh, I'm free at Wednesday at 2. Bang, bang, bang. Then you have ramen, FOP. A little walk around Leicester Square, maybe a cinema by yourself, and home in time for another sleepless night. I'm on new sleeping pills.
Oh, yeah? Mm. Are they like proper ones?
Well, they're sort of twice as strong as the ones I was on before.
For a second there, I thought you'd fallen asleep, so I was thinking they're pretty good.
I do feel a little bit like I'm in slow motion today.
So is it like, does it mean that, does it have an effect like that on your day thing? I mean, I've never been able to get, the only times I've sort of had trouble sleeping, I've been to like a pharmacist and the only thing they've been able to give me.
It's Nitol.
It's not even Nitol. It was like a kind of, it was one of them things that I know is like a sort of...
Psychosomatic.
Yeah, you sort of go, but I know this is nonsense.
The herbal one.
The herbal one. Mm. I was looking at it going, well, I know this doesn't work. But weirdly, it did seem to work.
Weirdly? I mean, I know these don't work, so I took them. I was like, these aren't going to work. But weirdly, they
I just was hoping that somehow these herbs that are unscientific somehow might actually have something in them that might actually scientifically work. It was actually only a very short period where I had trouble sleeping.
I've never been able to sleep. I think the secret is go to sleep when you're tired. That's it.
I think that's it. I think whenever I try and work through it, or it's too early, I think I stay up and then I can't sleep.
That's like the opposite of what I said.
No, like if I'm tired and it's too early to go to bed, to go to sleep, I try and sort of keep myself awake and try and watch something. And then like an hour or two later, when it is time to go to sleep, I can't go because I've just woken myself up.
Oh, I see what you're saying. But like, it's never too early for me to go to sleep. I'm never like, oh, it's 8:45. Oh, I better go to bed. It's never then. It's always like, well, I'm tired. It's midnight. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I tend to fall asleep. I was on these sleeping pills that didn't do very much. And it was like a luggage carousel where you're waiting for your luggage to come along and you see your luggage. And then you go to get your luggage, but you miss your luggage, and then you just got to wait for the luggage to come around again. And that's what sleep was like. You can feel yourself very tired, and you're almost there, and you have to concentrate very hard on falling asleep. And then if you miss it, you're wide awake, and then you've got to wait for the cycle to sort of like complete itself again. Awful. Just terrible. I found a few things that have helped. Is everybody, but what I saw a tweet yesterday and someone was talking about sleeping. So is everybody having difficulty sleeping in lockdown?
I now am not, because I don't have a regular routine and I don't really have to get up for anything.
Yes, but not just you, Nat.
Yeah, no, but no one else can hear you. Well, yes, but they can only hear you in the future.
Yeah, but I'm asking you about everyone else because you've already said that you have absolutely no qualms in going to bed at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Funny enough, I think the pills I took were called qualms or something like that.
Calms?
Maybe it was calms.
Calms? Aren't they meant to stop you from getting stressed out before an exam?
Oh, maybe it's that. Maybe it's a similar thing. Well, I think that's a problem. I think I don't have a routine at the minute.
They stopped me from getting stressed out before an exam, but when I was taking the exam, I was completely naked and my pens were made of sausages. then I realised I was dreaming. But what are other people? Do you think other people are having...
Yeah,
well, Natalie's saying yes. Zopiclone. Tell me, Natalie, Zopiclone. I think the one I'm taking begins with a Z. Does a Z? Hello.
Hey! Hey, guys!
It's with a Z.
I'm drinking some Mountain Dew and eating some Three Musketeers bars.
What's that? Is it All Saints song?
Yes, I know what you mean.
It's such a good song, and they do it. They say Z. The alphabet runs right from A to Z. And then later on they go, the alphabet runs right from A to Z. And they have another rhyme and you go, that's great. That is great. I love it because you're kind of like, they're not just completely selling out for an American market. It has artistic value to it. They're rhyming with Z and Z. One of the best rhymes in one of my songs, and I don't talk about my stuff that often. One of the best rhymes in one of my songs is where you think it's going to rhyme with Z, but it doesn't. It rhymes with Z.
Oh, that's nice.
Can't remember what song it is. If it answers on a postcard, I'm so spaced out. I don't know. Natalie, you can keep writing stuff with Z's on it, but they're upstairs next to my bed. I'm not going to stop a broadcast to have a one-way conversation with you, but apparently people are having difficulty sleeping. I think it's because people aren't out and about and like getting exhausted, but also there's a lot of stress involved. Anyway, have difficulty sleeping. I've just stopped trying to go to bed normal times. I'll go to sleep about 3 o'clock in the morning. What I do is I play word games on my phone whilst watching Grand Designs. Just as I'm about to fall asleep, I'll switch on RMSI. What is it called?
I know what you mean. What is that thing called?
Jordan Brooks's favourite thing in the world.
Yeah, what are they called? I know what you mean.
ASI.
ASMR.
ASMR. Switch on one of them of a thunderstorm on Jurassic Park. It's 3 hours long. And I've told you this before, right?
I think you have. Isn't it from an audiobook or something there?
No, it's not an audiobook. It's just a thunderstorm on Jurassic Park. Someone's gone to Jurassic Park with some sound equipment. They've launched themselves up in one of them high hides from the Lost World novel by Michael Crichton.
Sure.
And they're up there in the trees, and you can hear the rain, can't you? You can hear the rain pitter-pattering down in the trees, and there's thunder in the distance. Mm-hmm. And then every so often you can hear a brachiosaur just go...
Because there is okay.
Sounds more like a drum roll than rain, but that's the corrugated roof of the high hide for you.
Yeah. That's nice. I would have thought being in hearing the sounds of Jurassic Park would be kind of a bit worrying, because you know, as the rating suggests, it does contain some mild peril. Being in Jurassic Park, I don't know if I'd like.
It's important to remember you're not in Jurassic Park the movie; you're in Jurassic Park the place.
So it's before anything's gone wrong. It's the dream of John Hammond's dream of Jurassic Park.
Well, I think you're more on sort of like a fact finding. Adventure. It's do you know the best part of any film, any book is the beginning. The best Lord of the Rings film is the first 25 minutes of the first one when they're just packing lunch. You know,
they're like, I don't know if that's so. Would Jurassic Park be a better film if it just ends with like Sam Neill going, "Hey, what do you think, Sam?" And he's just like, "Fucking brilliant."
On paper,
goes.
On paper, it looks like a bit of a nightmare.
I had a brilliant time.
I'd probably put a few more safety restrictions up. Maybe a sign. If you know, you can tell people. You can tell people again. You can tell people three times. But if you put a sign there, then it really drills it home. A big sign saying, "Don't walk through the electric fence." Yeah. Aside from that, I thought it was great. I like the fact that you've got different price ranged restaurants. I think it's great. I think the merchandise is a little expensive, but, you know, I suppose if you're staying in Jurassic Park in the first place, you've got the money, you know. There could probably be a few other things non-dinosaur related on the island.
You know, TripAdvisor rating?
Monday to Thursday when you're not feeling like going to the park, but... TripAdvisor, what's that out of 5?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give it a 4.
Oh, cheers.
I thought it was really good. I thought it was really good. My name's not Alan Grant.
That's the end.
Just can't work these bloody seatbelts. That's him leaving. It's a call back to the beginning when he couldn't work out how to sleep back.
It's like a good ending.
Do you know that? I've told you this before, haven't I? The seatbelt thing is meant to be kind of like a metaphor for the film.
No.
You get a male part of a seatbelt and you get a female part of a seatbelt.
Right.
The female part of the seatbelt is the clasp.
Oh.
And the male part of the seatbelt is the bit that looks like a dick.
Yes.
Yeah. So you stick the dick into the clasp.
Yes.
That's the male and the female part. But in Jurassic Park, all of the dinosaurs are female.
Yeah.
So when he's on the helicopter, he's a paleontologist that just doesn't like the modern world. Seatbelts.
He's also a man.
He's a man and he doesn't like seatbelts. And so what he does is he gets two female seatbelts, ties them together, life finds a way.
Ah, I like that.
Yeah. It's like a little visual metaphor for the rest of the film. You've seen it, but you haven't maybe worked it out for yourself. I think that I like Robinson Crusoe at the beginning when he is in a shipwreck. Swiss Family Robin at the beginning when they're in a shipwreck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Journey to the Centre of the Earth when at the beginning when they pack for dinner. You know, it was like, well, we're going to need 30 yards of rope. We're going to need some boxes of salted cod. We're going to need a cask of brandy and, you know, some Hessian socks, a flint pickaxe for climbing. You know, there's always like this list of kind of like stuff that they need. And they're always like really like old-fashioned, archaic things. You know, a matchstick and some water for... To make a compass? Why not a compass, grandfather? Because we're out on in the wild. You know, stuff like that, isn't it? 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? No, not read or seen that, but I imagine it's very similar.
I'll tell you what, it's a treat, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Well, the film or the book? One,
Disney. I've not read the book.
Well, Kirk Douglas,
James Mason.
Go on.
I'm just saying. It's a hard recommend. I've seen it twice in the last year, I think, so I enjoyed it so much.
There's a scene at the beginning where Kirk Douglas turns up with two women on his arms and then he gets on the submarine. And he was just like, if I'm going to be spending the entire film in this sausage factory, I need people to know that I'm all man.
So his shape in it, it's like he looks like Popeye in it. His shape is basically exactly the same as Popeye. He's got this huge kind of like torso that goes down into this sort of very kind of thin waist. I think he's sort of that kind of, it's kind of a body type you don't really see now, but I reckon it's kind of like a male ideal of that time. I think he probably looks like those sort of 50s bodybuilder magazines or something. So you go, no one looks like that now. But it's also weird that you kind of, Kirk Douglas, even though he was making films up till like, you know, 70s, 80s, as a kind of aging leading man, you don't really get to see what he looks like, where he's like, God, look at him, he's like a proper muscly bloke in the sort of late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, it's impressive.
Kirk Douglas.
But yeah, like the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring, is that what the first one's called?
Yeah, Lord of the Ring.
And Sam's like, we're going on a quest, Sam. Well, sir, we better pack some sandwiches. And that's what they're doing. They make the first 45 minutes of the first Lord of the Rings film is Sam and Frodo making sandwiches.
I'll be honest, I really struggled with that first Lord of the Rings film when it came out.
Oh, it's just them when they're making sandwiches. You know the one.
It's basically one.
Well, what should we have on Tuesday, sir? Why not peanut butter and jelly? Well, we're having them on the Monday. Oh, are we? Well, I guess ham and mustard. Certainly, sir. Certainly. Pass me the Baco foil. And, you know, they, like, wrap up all of their sandwiches, don't they?
Right.
Baby bells to keep us going on the journey, sir? Or would it be cheese strings? Why not both? We're going on an awfully big adventure. All right, so you had a couple of spicy pepperonis to break things up on the way. And, you know, they spend the first 45 minutes of the film packing those lunch boxes, don't they? One of them's got a night ride to the lunchbox, and the other one has got a get along gang lunchbox because it was such a long time ago, way back in the 80s when they went on this adventure. And they set off, don't they? And they're not 10 minutes down the road before Sam's eaten all of the sandwiches, and then they're in all sorts of trouble eating berries off the. But these are slow berries, sir. They're awfully bitter on my tongue. Tastes like eating powder. Which was a quote from this week's Rick Stein. Well, it could have been a Rick Stein from many moons ago, but I saw it this week. Anyway, those are the best parts of any adventure. The middle part of every adventure is always an elf skateboarding down a portcullis in the middle of a big fight. That's the middle part of all of these things.
It's rubbish. It goes all like a computer game.
Absolutely rubbish. And then it never ends. But the best part of every adventure film, my favourite ever was Famous Five Valley of Adventure. Oh, I've talked about this. Famous Five Valley of Adventure. And they just had lots of tins of tinned ham, tinned pilchards, tinned pears, you know, and they would steal from the supplies of their enemies from the back so as not to draw attention to it. And they would have midnight feasts of spam and prunes. You think, what an adventure those five kids must have been on. I just always think that they're the best.
It's true. You've given me a nice, warm feeling. I do. I think those things do have that kind of effect on you. But you do almost go, I quite like to be out and eat some pears in tins or something.
Imagine being on Jurassic Park in a high hide where it's safe. You're not with a bunch of ecologists that are messing things up. You're not with a bunch of evil InGen scientists, yeah? You're not with a chaotician. It's just you and Marty McFly's girlfriend, and you're in the back of his 4x4, and she goes, where's Marty? And you're like, I killed him. And you're on Jurassic Park, and it's raining very heavily.
Yeah.
And there's thunder and lightning, and in the very distance you can hear what might be a threat, might not be a threat. It's a dinosaur mooing or calling. Oh. And you just think, well, there are problems out there, but they're very far away and they're for another time. At the moment we're safe, we're warm, it's raining, but we're not in the rain. Good night, Jennifer.
That's when you go to sleep.
She doesn't, obviously, because you've kidnapped her and she's absolutely terrified. But
you killed her boyfriend.
And she's on Jurassic Park and you've killed her time-travelling boyfriend. But you're all right. First time you've slept in years. It's time for a song.
This is the new one from you can probably guess who it is.
Mark Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. And we're back. We're back. We are all social debris. We're back. And do you know what? Not only are we back during this show, and we're back this week, we're back all... Do you know where else we're back, Nat?
No, where are we back?
We're back in the fucking charts in Malta. We're number 45 in the Maltese fucking comedy charts today.
Yes, that's what it is. It's comedy, is it? Oh, comedy. And in... Ireland?
And Ireland. We're at fucking 76 in Ireland.
That's all right. That's close to home. I don't know why that should feel better than Malta.
It doesn't.
It does to me. I feel like, yeah. I feel like it's home, doesn't it?
Oh. Oh, I know. I know. How else are you doing, Nathaniel?
I'm doing all right, I think. I mean...
Still feeling good about Brexit?
Well, you know, we've rolled out the vaccines, Nick. I mean, it's
Boris and Co are finally coming through for you, so that's not bad. Good for you. It's all coming out Metcalf at the moment, isn't it? Well done.
Well, as you know, I just kind of, I'd love to go to Malta. I'd love an invite, I guess. I mean, also, I think it's probably easier, probably not now, actually, post-Brexit, but I was saying, there's even a chance that, you know, I could do a gig in Ireland, probably. It's not beyond, out of the question, is it? Someone could invite me. It's quite easy to get to.
You're going to go back?
More of a mission, doesn't it?
Are you going to go back to doing gigs?
Don't know, you know. I mean, it feels so weird. I feel, honestly, like an imposter at the minute. I feel like I wasn't doing a lot of stand-up before the pandemic, but I was always keeping my hand in and always kind of basically doing everything I was asked to do. And then I'd sometimes have moments where I'd book loads and do those. And now I feel like I've really lost my identity in the last
Have they
year.
Found you? Have they just found you?
Do you know what I mean? I feel like sort of an imposter. I almost feel a bit like, did I ever do that? It feels so kind of alien.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of like on time.
Oh, took a year...
You've lost me. I was on and off gigs for a long time. I took a year off for a bit, and then I started getting back into it, and I was halfway through a tour. Then the tour got extended, and then lockdown happened, and so I wasn't really doing gigs, but I was doing kind of like my solo stuff, and so because it's kind of like when COVID first came along and when lockdown first happened, it wasn't something like that was in our calendars that we were preparing for. It was just something that sort of like came along. We didn't know how long, so it's not really clear in my head exactly where I was and what I was doing. I don't know how much of a comedian I was when it started. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like in my mindset and my headset, what I was thinking, what I was doing. So it doesn't feel like, it's not like, I guess, I mean, I wasn't like working in NatWest every day. And then all of a sudden I wasn't allowed to work in NatWest because it's such a fluid thing, isn't it? Mm. You're never working 100% of the time, and it's not kind of like you have like it's not like you clock in and clock out. It's kind of like you're always sort of thinking about it.
Yeah, I was weirdly at that point as well, where I know in January last year or December I was talking about doing Machantleth, and I think I was sort of like, I don't know, what can I do? And Henry, who organises it, was saying basically try and do a new show, but like I'm always sort of trying to get out of doing a new show, like doing something like, oh, maybe I'll do a mixed bill or something like that, or I'll run something. And I think he sort of said, nah, do a new show, but don't feel the need to have an hour. So I went, all right. So my plan was to try and write 40 or 50 minutes for May, and then if I needed an extra 10 minutes, I'd have someone come on and do like a support or something.
That's insane.
But I know that you sort of do, you really throw yourself in, don't you? And you can kind of, you know, you have very few notes on a bit of paper and you pull out an hour of it. Whereas to me, it feels much more, I don't know, I find that terrifying.
It's terrifying up until you start and then you look at your notes and you look at the clock and you realise you've done half an hour on one note. And then you're like, oh, I could do 3 hours, you know. Mm. But you can't replicate that, you know, which I think is what, that's what I enjoy the, I mean, that's what I enjoy the most.
Yeah.
I enjoy work in progress and I enjoy the audience knowing that it's not a show.
And I think I do.
I enjoy knowing it's not a show, and I enjoy both of us knowing that I'm trying to do a show, and there will be a show at some point, and maybe some of this will end up in the show, but for right now, for all intents and purposes, this is all disposable, and we're all there just to have fun, and when all of that pressure is taken off me, I am working at 100% of my abilities.
Yeah.
As soon as you add a TV camera, an element of pressure to it, the percentage of my ability to harness what I'm capable of diminishes. So I get more nervous, and when I get more nervous, I'm more panicky. And I don't think as well off the cuff when I'm in a competitive environment. Like if I was to do a panel show or something like that, I never feel like I come across particularly good on panel shows. I felt my most relaxed when we were doing heavy entertainment because it was mine and we just recorded until we got the episode done. So those records were really long. They were like 2 hours because the idea was we would cut it all down. I was at my most relaxed. There wasn't time limit. It was a home team. I didn't have to prove myself. People were there just to see me. And I'm really good in those situations. And I really enjoy my company for those reasons. And then as soon as you get the tour, where you're wheeling out the same thing every night, and it works great 80% of the time, and then 15% of the time, it's slightly difficult to get them on board at first, but then you win them over. And then 5% of the time, they're just like really tough gigs. Or 4% of the time they're really tough gigs, and 1% of the time you're in Southampton, and it's just, what's the fucking point in coming to Southampton? It's the last gig of the tour. We've already fucking done London. Why are we in Southampton? It's booked Southampton after London. And then you're in Southampton and there's 5 cunts on the front row that are too drunk to fucking listen, and then ruining it for everyone else that's bought tickets. And you're just thinking, what is the fuck? I can't even do the fucking show. I've attempted to start the same bit 4 times. I can't do it. And the security guard's just watching you and you go, get them out! Get them out! This is beyond the point that they're not heckling. They're just too drunk. They're just chatting at fucking high volume and no one's doing anything about it. This isn't my fucking job. You know, don't miss that. I really love that. It, but you know, when someone like Tommy Tiernan would do like a whole month or like a tour of like, oh, I'm going to do improv every night. Mm. I remember that was a thing, and it was just kind of like people like going, oh, it didn't work tonight, and it was really hit and miss. I think because what you've done is you've taken something that's meant to be work in progress, and you've made it into a show, and then all of a sudden the pressure's back, where it's like, yeah, it's improv, but people are still expecting an hour of comedy because this is the show. Whereas what I like is the fact that you go, it's work in progress, it probably won't be very good. And then it's always, I would say, with my work in progresses, the ones that I've done, I've always... I did McCuntless 1 year where I did... 8 work in progress shows. They're an hour each, and like you said, I'd go on with a few notes, and I'd do, because I was prepping heavy entertainment, so I needed 6 episodes that were all on a different subject, and we did 6 hours, and then I worked in another 2 for rollover material, just in case we ran out of time at any of them, and I could kind of like do like a collection of stuff that we didn't have time for, or I think one of them was that, and then one of them was like an alternative subject matter. And that was great. And there was one that didn't work at all. And that was because it was the sex one that was on at 7 o'clock on a Saturday. And because I was doing so many gigs that weekend, it was just filled with families, because I think mine was one of the only shows that you can get tickets for. Because 7 o'clock on a Saturday night was like, you know, peak, what you call it?
It was sort of in between people going to see their late shows and...
Yeah.
Dinner or whatever.
Yeah, it was. All of the comedians were doing one show, and they were on at 7 o'clock on Saturday, and I was doing 8 shows, and one of them was about that time. So everyone, you know, so that's fair enough. But like the people that couldn't get into the shows that they wanted to go and see were like, "Oh, we'll go and see that then," and it was just all families that were there to see me talk about like anal sex, and I was just like, "Okay." So I improvised an hour on the Hairy Bikers. I didn't change the material that much. And it was, do you know what I mean? It was like, that's the only one that didn't work out that well. But apart from that, like all of the others were really fun and interesting. And they were like surprising to me and surprising to the audience. And I guess I missed that the most out of live stuff. I miss the fact that, you know, I will scramble together a bunch of notes and then go on stage with like notes in my hand, and then I will barely reference them, and then I can talk for an hour. Hmm. I just find that you can do comedy, you know, if you're out there and you want to do comedy and you think there's a specific way of doing it, there's not. There's not a specific way of doing it. I have had people telling me, like, my whole career that I'm doing it wrong. and unless you're just absolutely not making people laugh, and as self-deprecating as I am, I mean, if I couldn't make people laugh, I wouldn't do it. And I love making people laugh. Like, I love making people laugh on a social level, but I love it on a professional level, you know, I miss that loads. I always used to make people laugh in the pub, not like as a comedian, but just as a person. And I just think it's a skill that I'm really grateful for. And if you're out there and so that's the only thing, if you want to be a comedian and you don't make people laugh, then maybe it's not for you. But any other way to go about doing it, it's up to you.
Mm. I think what we both have is safety nets. Your safety net is that those bits of paper that you may or may not use. And I essentially need to have a almost like written script. But when I listen back to what I say, it's never like the stuff I've written.
Mm.
I've made my own way of telling that story. But in my head, I think I've learned. But what I've actually done is I've remembered a completely different way of doing it.
But you remember the points, don't you?
Yeah.
The thing is, stand-up isn't a written thing. It's an oral thing. It's a verbal thing. So, you know, my writing voice is different from my speaking voice. Mm. I wrote a thing about Christopher Plummer and The Sound of Music this week. You know, such an important film in my life. I don't know if it was the first film I ever saw at the cinema, but I know it's one of the first that I'd ever seen at the cinema. And I know that I've always loved it. And I wrote about it, and then I reread what I'd written, and it was very flouncy, and I would never say it out loud. And in actual fact, if I'd heard myself say it out loud like that, or if I'd heard someone else say it out loud like that, I'd have written them off as a ponce, right? But that's how I felt, and I wrote about it, and I am capable of writing like that, but when I don't speak like that, because I edit myself, and I you know, I don't want to be, I want to speak how I feel and I want to write how I think. And I don't know, but I think that if I was to write my stand-up down and learn it as a monologue, it would be completely different. And also, it would take you a lot longer to get to punchlines, don't you think, Nat?
Yeah, I quite like the, I mean, part of what I do, I quite like the roundabout way in which I get to a punchline. But yeah, it won't be that. But I think what I need is that safety net. So I almost need to have it written to sort of prove to myself that that's what it, you know, that could be a show. If I read that out, it would take 50 minutes or an hour or whatever.
Absolutely. I write on my hand and I very rarely look at my hand when I'm on stage. But I know it's there. If you know, some people say, why don't you just write it on a piece of paper? And it's just like, because then you've got to get a piece of paper out of your pocket. Your hand is there. You write it on your hand, it's there. You know, you're not searching for a piece of paper. You just glance at your hand, it's there. Yeah, and I think that is a safety net. It helps me do the job that I do. And there's no one that's ever said that, there's no book that's saying that you can't do that. And it's kind of like, that's what I need in order to do it. And if you're out there and you're just kind of like, bloody, I always just think, fucking hell, how does Jack D remember a whole hour of material? And then I did my first hour and I was like, oh my God, that was remarkably. My first hour, I'm not saying my first hour was good. It wasn't bad, but I'm not saying I can't remember it that well. I remember it wasn't bad and I did a lot of poetry in there. But what I'm saying is that I found doing an hour so much easier than doing 15 or 20 minutes. And
me too.
My memory is fucked. I can't remember, you know, lyrics. I can't remember words. It takes me ages to get kind of like scenes learned for when I'm acting and stuff. And so one of the biggest intimidating aspects of stand-up was how to remember all that stuff. And you do.
Yeah, last Edinburgh, I 2 weeks before Edinburgh started, didn't know it. And I was really worried because you start thinking, I'm sure last every other time I've done this, it would be like I'd have known it by now. You probably don't. And then on the day or a few days before, you just go, oh, I do know it. I'm just not. It's just something I'm using to beat myself up about. Whereas actually, when thrown into it, you kind of just do know it. Well, and I can try and put a couple of cheats somewhere where if I need to reference something, I can, but I'd never do.
But if you do know it, have a book. Do you know what I mean? Write it down. Because it's not, comedy isn't a memory test. Comedy is, if you make them laugh, then you've succeeded. And if you then you haven't.
That's where I was, though, this time last year with this idea of, like, kind of my headspace was in a kind of, I might try and write something new and then and see what it's like and not be like, oh, I'll definitely turn this into a show, but, like, do it and see if you think it's funny or worthwhile or worth developing. And now when the pandemic came along, it sort of threw that off a bit and it was like, I guess I'm abandoning those notes that I was writing in January and February last year. And now I guess it all seems like, what do audiences want? Do they want you to talk about this? Do they want you not to talk about this at all? I sort of feel like the latter, that it almost would feel weird not to mention it. And I think because I was in that headspace of trying to come up with something new, I think the idea of someone like a few people have gone out like doing gigs now online, doing new material or something, just feels a bit like, I don't know whether I should be trying to do something new or whether I should be trying to do something that I was writing in January, February last year. And that's the stuff I'd probably be most interested in doing still. But it's now at this point where I don't know. It's sort of like, am I now taking up space? Are there so few places in stand-up for people? Who knows what it's going to be like when it's all...
It's not your job to make room for other people.
No, I guess it just doesn't feel like now I could do a gig. If someone said, I mean, I could do one, I could pull one out of old material or whatever. If someone said if I had to do 20 minutes or something, whereas but I also sort of feel like I've got I was sort of in my last time I did it, I was sort of thinking about doing something entirely new. So what now I'm a bit. You? I don't know.
But, so A, what do you want to do? Yeah, it sounds to me like doing an hour of old is you filling time because you've got to do a show.
Hmm.
Right. So do something new. And also, I think that we've been in lockdown so long that you don't have to, you can mention lockdown because it's part of life now without having to do a show about lockdown.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't think anyone wants a show about lockdown. I'm really looking forward to this, to getting back and writing a show. I know what my show is going to be about. I'm excited about writing that show. I'm not going to write it until I need to, but I've got it in the back of my head. This is the show, this is what I'm going to do, and it's going to be great. I'm really excited about it. But until that point, I'm not going to write it ready and be kind of like, oh, I've written an hour and I can't use it. I'm just going to wait until we do it, and then it's that. If you want to write something, write it, and if you don't. You know, but don't feel like, you know, oh, well, what do people want to hear from me about? I might as well leave the room open for other people to. That's up to them if they want to do their stuff.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I agree with you totally. I also just think at the minute it feels a bit odd, doesn't it? Because there isn't this sort of everything feels a bit unknown. Like I'm sure things will come back, but until they do, I feel a bit. And I'm sure whenever I do it again, it would feel weird in a way that it hasn't felt weird since 2007 or whatever. Yeah. Like, I think if I did it again now, I'd be like, ooh.
But the thing is, I haven't quit doing stand-up, and I haven't quit as a comedian, but what I don't feel the need to be is a pioneer. I don't feel like I need to be the first person back to doing it. It's just kind of like, you know, I just remember when they were like, lockdown first started and I had like some TV stuff in development and they were like, oh God, these are great, but have you got any ideas that we could do that's sort of like lockdown, you know, related? And I was like, what do you mean, like a sitcom based in lockdown? And they were like, no, not really, but one that kind of like you could film with social distancing. And then I spent ages trying to think of, you know, well, if you're going to do a TV show and it was like social distance, well then the crew would have to be socially distanced. And I started trying to think of kind of like all these, like, and I was like really stressing about it. And it's just like, Nick, it's not your responsibility to single-handedly work out how the TV industry is going to continue, you know, under social distancing and COVID. And of course it's not, it wasn't, you know, you could have pitched anything back then. Everyone was just panicking and it's just kind of like, America's got that sorted. Do you know what I mean? It's just like there's other people that have got that sorted. You don't need to. And I feel like in terms of stand-up, I don't need to be the person that works out how to do live shows. I don't need to be the person that goes back and does kind of like shows in a car park and stuff like that. I think the people that have done that are brilliant. Good for them. They're probably better at doing stand-up than I am. I need to be in a certain mood, a certain night, with the right candles being lit and a bubble bath, and I need to be wined and dined, and then I'm ready to do stand up, right? But some people can just turn it on, and that's amazing to me. But I'm not like that, so I don't feel the pressure. But when we're all allowed back and everyone else is doing gigs, and someone will say to me, Nick, do you want to do a gig? I'll be like, yeah, give me a month. And I'll write it. But I'm not thinking about it till then.
That's good. I think I'm the same. I'm not, I guess I can't really think about it. It's sort of going on in the background where I'm a bit like, what am I doing? But I guess I'm also a bit, I'm not making those decisions till things are open again and I can actually do them. Or not.
Well, we could have talked about many things this week, but we talked about that.
It's interesting.
Interesting. Who knows? Who knows? Have we got any time? We'll do like a couple of fan mails and then we'll play a song and then we'll get our guest on.
Yeah.
Are you ready, Brian? By the way, R.I.P. Christopher Plummer. He made a lot of films. He was basically the go-to movie shit, though, wasn't he? He was such a horrible piece of shit in so many films. And even half of The Sound of Music, which, you know, he resisted his whole life, but he was fucking good in that film. That is his best film, I think, that and Star Trek VI. And you think Star Trek VI? He's so good in Star Trek VI! And he's so good in The Sound of Music, and he's good in a lot of other films. I'm watching halfway through Dreamscape right now, and you go, yeah, he's a classic Christopher Plummer being a shit. He's brilliant in Dragnet. I think Dragnet is a terrible film. He's brilliant in Dragnet because he's really having fun, and he brings this kind of, like, heightened...
I know someone recommended Silent Partner the other day to Christopher Plummer films, and that is worth watching if you want to see Christopher
Plummer. I've got it on Blu-ray. I've got it coming on Blu-ray, and that and the Sherlock Holmes one.
Oh, yeah, I've got that. That's good.
What's that one called?
Is it Study in Terror, or is it...
It's the Jack the Ripper one.
Yeah, there's two Jack the Ripper ones. That's why I'm trying to think of it. Study in Terror, or... I can't remember. There's two that basically come out a year apart.
Right.
And Strahd's played by the same man in both of them, but they're weird.
I've got the Christopher Plummer James Mason one coming. I'm going to watch both of those, and then I've done my Christopher Plummer tribute. Maybe we'll talk about Christopher Plummer next week. Yeah. Anyway, here, love this fan club. I'm making the plan this year. I want Johnny Bowden. I don't want to send that.
What have you got?
It's brackets.
Oh, sorry. Not poor.
Fucking hell. Can you suggest some for me, Terry? No, I'm not really into films with animals in them.
They're for executives.
Babe. Hey, Nick! Hey, Nuts! Hey, Nuts!
Andy.
Last week you had someone saying how fit Nick was. Nuts, I felt bad. I felt bad, so wanted to let you know you're okay too. I think Nick Nolte is fitter than both of you, but keep on the good show work. Would love a cunt shout out, please. Thanks, Chris.
This often.
Bad news for you, Nat. You've got a guy that has terrible sentence structure for a start that thinks you're fitter than me. So
he does. I think he's saying that I'm okay, which isn't really even. I think it's like a backhanded compliment.
It's kind of like the whole thing's a backhanded letter, really. And then he's telling us both that Nick Nolte's. I mean, it depends what era Nick Nolte. If you're saying Three Fugitives, Nick Nolte, then absolutely fine. But if you're saying Hulk, Nick Nolte,
oh yeah,
then please forget about it. Forget about it, yours. Dear Nick and Nat, big fan of the show and all you guys. I was looking for one of Nick's DVDs on eBay the other day and came across some interesting merchandise, and I glued some screenshots up. I was just wondering if you knew about them. I think that's what we've had today.
Yeah.
Thanks, Blake. Kiss. Dear Nick and Nat, how are you doing, boys? What are you doing for Valentine's Day? I remember that last year you had Ramesh on. That episode was so funny. Thanks, Holly.
Yeah, we've had a lot of funny episodes since.
Hi, Nick and Nat. I recently watched The Deadly Cool and I loved it. Have you watched it? In the film, John Malkovich plays the gangster grandpa that everyone should have. Do you like him as an actor? I love him. Cheers, Matt.
I love John Malkovich.
Yeah, I don't know the film, though.
Don't know the film at all. What's it called? The Deadly Code? Yeah. We're both going to watch that and we'll talk about it next week.
Murder by Decree.
Right, okay, we're going to play a song and then we're going to get our guest on.
Yeah.
Thanks for your mail. Keep it coming in.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on. thought of you as my mountaintop. Thought of you as my peak. Thought of you as everything I've had but couldn't keep. I've had but couldn't keep. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes. If I could make the world as pure and strange as what I see, I'd put you in the mirror I put in front of me. I put in front of me. Linger on.
Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. We're back. We're talking about tank tops with our guest, Nell Frizzell. We're joined in the studio live. We're not live, but we're joined by Nell Frizzell.
I am alive, if that counts for anything.
You're alive, but we are not live. You've got a book called The Panic Years, which came out yesterday on February the 11th.
It did indeed.
Because that's the most professional thing I've ever done, Nell.
I feel like I'm in... Oh, what's that film that's all told backwards by writing on his arm? I feel like I'm in that.
Memento.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've remade that with olives. It's called Pimento. So what we were just talking about tank tops. I think it's worth pointing out that a tank top in America is a vest.
Yeah.
Sweater vest.
No, just a vest.
A vest.
So what Bruce Willis wears in Die Hard is a tank top.
Which is... Grubby white tank top.
Why?
What is the tank in tank top?
I think it's because you're like a tank, right?
Or is it because that's what you might wear in the military?
Or when you're fueling up a train.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Well, Natalie, could you look at what the origins of the name tank top is? I think the vest is...
T-shirt is that it's the shape of a T, isn't it? So tank top is not the shape of like a armored vehicle.
No, I think if in America a vest is a tank top and it's just flipped, right? So here we're a tank top is a jumper without arms, whereas in America that's a vest. So then is a vest what we'd call a vest here? Called a tank
but vestment is an old vest must be from vestment. Vestment of French Latinate word for clothes, right?
But then pants must be from pantaloons, right? And so
absolutely.
So Americans are right there, right?
Okay, we've got some sort of answer here. It is named after tank suits, one-piece bathing suits of the 1920s worn in tanks or swimming pools, like a tank. That's lovely.
They could be called Pinewoods. Like, we could have got a really good name.
What's a Pinewood?
Pinewood Studios got that famously big tank that they do all the water stuff in.
Yeah.
I once very nearly got photographed in that, and it didn't happen. It made me sad. I would have loved to.
What was the situation?
I was written... That's for me to know. No, I'd written a piece about swimming, and it was either they were going to photograph me in a tank in Pinewood quite expensively, or I would just jump in a pond for free and guess which one they went for.
How would this be like for a magazine?
Did you go to Pinewood?
Here's my anecdote. I'll give it to you again because it's absolutely fiery. I nearly went to Pinewood. Actually, cycle past Pinewood once when I decided to cycle from London to Oxford, maybe? One of the two. Yeah, I've cycled past Pinewood Studios.
But you said they gave you the choice between...
No. I think the picture editor was given the choice, and they looked at their spreadsheet and they thought, we can throw this woman in a puddle. Fuck her.
Oh.
My mate Hurley had his wedding at Pinewood Studios.
Whoa.
That was quite nice.
My friend Xander had his wedding at the Bodleian Library, I found out this week, which is very cool. It's the library with all the books in the world. Feel free to use this as a link to talk about my book. Just
I was about
FYI.
To say, your book. So your book has been about...
I'm going to hand deliver a copy to the Bodleian Library, whether they want it or not.
What is the Bodleian Library?
It's in Oxford. Basically, most of... if you were a rat in Oxford, it's very problematic because a lot of under the centre of town is just a giant library full of every printed book, I think, and maybe newspaper, although they probably digitize that now. So it's quite fun, and you can go in and like unspool these giant racks of like 17th century vellum manuscripts about
those racks are quite good fun.
Yeah,
the video library for football that I don't know anything about, and I used to look after, so I'd have people would be making little films of little football compilations. And they would call down and say, we need the UEFA Cup final 1997, 1998. And I'd go to these video racks and I'd turn the wheel and I'd get the thing for them and I'd bring it up to them and they would say, this is the Champions League final, not the UEFA Cup final. And I'd have to say things like, oh, what's the difference?
Yeah, come on, guys. I tell you my stack story? I used to work at the Women's Library in Whitechapel. That was my first job when I moved to London. And I went down to the stacks one day with the collections person. And there were books on one side and then there were artefacts on the other side. And one of the artefacts she got down for me was a jug of Victorian wooden and metal sex toys that they'd found in a brothel in Whitechapel when it closed.
A jug,
the original enamel jug full of like paddles and like scratchy things. My vocabulary on these is shaky. And they'd obviously the brothel closed in sort of the 20s or 30s, someone had said, actually, we should keep this because this tells a lot of the social history of women's lives. Mm. And then I held a teapot, the WSPU, Women's Social and Political Union, the suffragette teapot. I had a great time.
What was that? A teapot full of butt plugs?
Yeah. Yeah. Up each of the Pankhursts and then put in a pot to stew for all the others.
I like the idea that there's some sort of sex toy that's called a scratchy bit. Scratchy bit.
Oh, my husband, he loves the scratchy bit.
What is a scratchy bit?
It honestly looked like something you would tenderise meat with, but I think you'd tenderise meat with it.
Is it for like scratching your back? Because that can be kind of like...
Sexy?
Well, not just sexy. It's one of the best feelings in the world, isn't it, having your back scratched?
I think it looks sexy. It's like when I get my hair cut by an 80-something-year-old man, and I didn't dare go back in the period that I was allowed to get my hair cut in, because I'm sort of frightened these... You know, I don't know. You don't know when someone's that age now whether they've come through it.
You think what?
It's afraid to go back because of the COVID in the in between time.
Yes, but what are you saying?
I'm worried he's dying.
The way he touched your head.
Yeah, yeah. Because even though he's an 8-year-old man, I found it very...
He knows what he's doing. He's 80.
Here are some things that I would argue are physically akin to sex. And I'm talking like mediocre sex that I've experienced recently. Scratching a mosquito bite. Absolute heaven. Love it. Could do it all year.
I wouldn't say it's mediocre sex. I'd say that's right up there with the
best. Right up there with the best.
Well, I've got an expert, and sometimes if I scratch that with a comb, I'm like, oh, I mean, it's a terrible thing to do. It doesn't help it.
The picking and eating of a blister, which I don't do anymore, but I've watched my son, who's 3, discover it, and he's like, holy moly, you've just got 3 snacks on your body? This is incredible. Oh, come along.
I've never picked and eaten a blister.
Have you not?
That's just one of those things that I'm... How many people have you run this past now?
Well,
it might just be
you and Natalie. And
no, I can see how that would... I think I wouldn't be that disgusted by it. I mean, I wouldn't do it now, but I can understand it.
I had a friend at university that had a Tetley Tea T-shirt, and it had the gaffer on. It was very faded. It was long. It was like a muumuu. And he was a clean freak. He thought he was better than everyone else. He talked down to us all the time. And he'd walk in, he'd wear very short boxer shorts that were invisible underneath his muumuu and some slip-on slippers, which had sort of like Homer Simpson having a beer on them.
Was it the gaffer?
No, it wasn't. He was very, he was rake thin, and he would come in and he would hover in the doorway. And he would say, you know when you have a boil on your back and it bursts in the night and you wake up and your T-shirt is completely stuck to your back and there's a big yellow stain? And we'd all be like, no, right. Joe, no. And he'd go, yeah. And he'd leave the room. So that's like one of those moments, right?
Can I slightly up the vibe by saying I went to a party once wearing one of those giant Yorkshire tea, the bags that all the tea bags come in. It was so big that I wore it as a dress. And
I think that would be quite chic.
It was quite chic. I can't remember what the theme of the party was, but I remember thinking I have nailed this shut.
Did it fit you to a tea?
Hey, oh, good man. How long has that been stewing?
Oh, my God. Oh, Nathaniel, you're no longer welcome on this.
it's all right, but this is you.
Absolute classic bants going on here. It's brilliant. Right, OK, so picking and eating blisters, that's up there with... I would say that's up there...
With a wank.
With a sad wank on a rainy day at a bus stop.
The only way I do it.
OK, what else is... I would say a good having your back scratched and having your head massaged.
Well, I guess is having a head massage. As I say, Angelo, who's the Greek Cypriot man, is very nice. The other thing I like about it is he gives me a sweet... When I've had my hair cut, it gives me a bald sweet.
I've had this conversation, I think, with you, Nat, before, because I used to get my hair cut by a, like, 50-year-old Iraqi guy, and at the end, it was like a man's barber, but I had such short hair that I was like, I'm going to pay £12 for a haircut. And at the end, he would give me a single white paper tissue, and I never knew what to do with it. I just didn't know what it was for. The tipping thing was complicated enough, and then the tissue. I was like, what do I? Do I put more money? Like, is this for the check? Like, what do I do? So I would just fold it up and put it in my pocket.
It's for if you were a man, it would be to clean up those head massages.
I see. When you've unpicked your pocket and then you can just slip right through with the wet wipe, that is great.
These are the secrets of a man's world that no one really ever let me into.
Do you know what happened? The best day ever at that hairdresser's was when I went to my lunch break and a man next to me was having his head polished. A bald man who'd had his head like wet shaved and then with a tea towel, honestly, like you do on a bowling ball, with his head polished like that. It was so great. And I just watched agog.
Of course. I mean, that's what they should put on at the cinema, right?
Yeah.
If that was a film.
If there was a film of men having their heads polished and women putting their makeup on, we would flock to them.
It should be George Lucas would have produced it. What was that film that he made? Curismati. What was that film?
Charismaki.
Yeah. Well, no. You know the films that George Lucas produced of just stuff in slow motion?
I don't know.
You know. He made three of them. You know.
Star Wars.
Yeah, that's right. It's just stuff happening in slow motion. It's like RSMI, ASMR, only visual. And I think the idea is that you're meant to take mushrooms.
It's like IBM.
It's the
You
know what the films are. He didn't direct them. Him and Francis Ford Coppola produced them.
I think I do know.
The Grand Canyon, and you're flying over the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, I do know. What are they? I know what you mean.
Yes. They've got weird names.
They sound lovely.
They're really good. I bought
immersive.
I was around a friend's house and they were on in the background of the TV. I thought they look great and I bought them and I haven't watched them yet. And that was 20 years ago. But so they're not like urgent.
I feel like we've gone even more than usual. We have gone off topic.
Sorry.
Now,
so your book.
Yeah.
The Panic Years.
Yeah.
In 5 words, tell us what it's about.
A memoir of my panic.
Oh, there you go. That's not bad. Tell us about your book.
Well, I wrote it because when I was about 28, I had a sort of massive explosion in my life where I came out of a 6-year relationship and I got made redundant and I moved back in with my mum, and simultaneously all of my friends were like getting married or getting promoted or changing jobs or moving country or having like seismic occurrences in their life. I remember thinking, this is way more serious than puberty, but we don't have any name for it. No one told me it was coming. And I also didn't know why it was happening, but it seemed to be happening to everyone around me. All of my peers were in a state of flux. And so I kind of had this niggling idea and I knew there was something there, but I was too in the midst of it to really do anything with it. And then quick fast forward to when I was 32, I got pregnant and I suddenly realized that the thing that had really hit home at the beginning of what I've classified as the panic years was this sort of haunting realization that your fertility is finite, particularly if you're conditioned as a woman to think of your fertility as fleeting, and that you reach a stage in your life where you think, well, if I'm ever going to have a baby, I sort of need to get my life in gear. And that is a really troubling, unfair thing, because cisgendered men are never faced with that conundrum, and they're not conditioned to think of their fertility in the same way as women, and they don't have a kind of panic. In fact, they're sort of encouraged to live as happy 16-year-olds for as long as they possibly humanly can, and that lays the kind of burden of the decision whether or not you have children entirely in the laps and gussets of women or people with uteruses. And I found that very unfair. So when I saw someone said this lovely thing that when you're at the bottom of a very tall building, you can't see the building above you. You don't even realize it's there. But as you move away, it rises up behind you like a rocket and you realize it was looming over you the whole time. And so I think as I moved through my late 20s and early 30s, the prospect of motherhood and fertility suddenly roared up behind me and I saw it in the rearview mirror and thought, oh, that's what it was all about. And the fact that we don't have a term for it means that we can't really prepare people for it. You know, like we have things like puberty and adolescence or the menopause and midlife crisis and emptiness syndrome and all those things. But no one sort of says to you, oh, like you might be in the panic years, or like this might just be your flux. You're just sort of everyone, you have to explain in detail to everyone all the ways that your life has gone sort of technicolor, and either they fear or pity you. And there's not really a sense of empathy. So I've written a memoir of that time from 28 to 33 to sort of say, look, this is what happened to me. I think it deserves a name. What the hell is it? How can we make it better? And that is the book.
Because I think it's because we probably need to reclassify what it is to be people now. because we were all meant to have kids by the time we were 17 and dead by the time we're 33. And now we're all a lot older and people put stuff off. And, you know, teenagers are less than 100 years old. And it's kind of...
When yeah, they're a lot less. They're like...
They're 15. Like the 50s, weren't they? Like 70. No, but like in the 70s, they were invented in the 50s, weren't they?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
So it's kind of like... So that was like a thing. And it's kind of like, if you're a teenager and then you become an adult and then you're an adult for 70 years with no change and then you're old.
Yeah.
And there's no...
No, you're absolutely right. This whole phenomenon I'm talking about is really new because it's really only been ushered in by sort of widespread access to contraception and abortion and women's entry into the workplace. And by women, I mean middle-class women, because guess what? Working-class women have been working for fucking ever. So it's only really in the last two or three generations that people like me have had to decide whether or not to have children, and they've had to dictate their lives in order to either have them or not have them. So like I said in the book, panicking is itself a massive privilege. Obviously, I'm very privileged to live in a country where I can choose whether or not to have a child. And if I don't have a child, I then have a choice about other things that I do in my life. If I was, you know, if I'd been born in under different circumstances, I wouldn't have the panic in the same way. But I would still be hamstrung by some of the same problems and same issues. And I think that, you know, I was sort of glib about the way men are expected to act like teenagers for as long as they humanly can. But I think the invention of the teenager was sort of vague enough that you could say to people like, oh, you know, he's like, it basically became more socially acceptable in my 30s to talk about your trainers and collection of films and the way you like your sandwiches than to talk about an actual child that you might want or have growing in your body. And I thought that's not right. That's not okay.
I think you're very much on the wrong show, actually.
I've come into the very heart of the matter, I thought.
No, I think you have. I've been thinking a lot. I think I'm kind of, especially in lockdown, I found myself having this real existential crisis about just being this kind of, I'm 41 and I'm living my 41st year in lockdown where I get to think nothing, again, sort of privileged to be thinking about myself for a year.
Mm.
And I find it kind of, I find my life totally pathetic. And while I was feeling sorry for myself and being, you know, single in a pandemic and going, oh, that's a whole other year of my life gone. And then when I come out of it, I'm going to be 42 or 43. And it's such an adult age. And yet I saw something the other day and someone I follow tweeted and she put a thing on saying, oh, for me, as someone who was, she herself was single, she sort of mentioned, I've lost 12 eggs.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, yeah, it's even that. I don't think of, even in my terms of feeling sorry for myself, I still don't have that kind of, even though I can think of it and go, God, I'll be this sort of almost like early to mid-40s kind of man-child guy floating about. I still don't have it as bad as that. And I was feeling sort of sorry for myself and going, oh, actually, I'm still kind of lucky because I can still probably get away with it. But I do feel like I need to, like almost you do, like I think we do have this sort of weird, we're not, I don't think we're necessarily encouraged to be childlike for longer.
No, you're just forgiven. You're right, not encouraged. You're forgiven for being it in a way that I just felt such a pressure from, you know, lots of really well-meaning, kind people who would ask me over and over again what I was doing with my life. And there's a subtext there, which is, are you going to have a baby? And sometimes the subtext just becomes the full-blown question in itself. But I'm sorry if you're like that, Nat. But you're right that there is a viscerality, like the literal egg counter of what, like, I can't describe to you what it is like to be having that sort of existential panic about, like, how long have I got left? And will I ever meet someone in time? And do I even really want to have kids? And then, bingo, axe wound, bleeding out of your arse, an egg's fallen out of your body. There's another one gone. Holy shit. Like, how many more of these have I got? Mm. And my mum got the menopause at 40. So if I were you, like, I might have run out by now of eggs. And, like, that's quite a tricky thing to... It's quite a tricky thing to hold without going a bit nuts. And I think I did go a bit nuts. I think I would, you know, in my dating years from like 28 to 31, I was like this very odd conundrum for men in that I was had a raging libido and like really quite aggressive sexual appetite and career ambition. And simultaneously was really worried that I was going to run out of time to have a baby. So you had the prospect of someone that was like, right, let's run up a mountain, split a log, have loads of sex, let's smoke loads, drink loads, and then you better be ready to have a baby with me within a year, which is quite a lot to give to someone. But it wouldn't be much if men were conditioned to think about their own fertility as finite and fleeting, because your likelihood of having a conceiving and having a healthy full-time pregnancy after 35 does decrease as a man, just not at the same rate as a woman.
But again, it's not something that's really talked about, is it? It's that is like male fertility is something that also goes. I mean, just because we can, we're going, didn't Des O'Connor have a baby when he was like 70?
It's always bloody Des O'Connor and Mick Jagger, two men who I don't know if I'd choose as my dads if I if I had the option.
And to be fair, Charlie Chaplin.
How was he? There you go.
Was he an old dad?
He was like 90, wasn't he?
Whereas on our side, we get like, there are brilliant people. Joe Brand has written really amazingly about being an older mum. And they're definitely, definitely massive benefits to being an older parent. I think it's just the idea that one of you is panicking that they're going to run out of time and the other one is resisting the commitment. That's unfair.
Well, my parents are old. Like, I'm 41.
Oh, yeah.
My mum's 84.
Yeah,
so she would have had me when she was 43. So I guess also maybe that's in my head as well. Like you just, but I mean, there's no real excuse for it. And I also think you say there's like, there. It's not like I have no awareness of
women. Of course not.
It's not like we're totally alien to the concept.
No, and thank God for men like you who are allies in that. It's true. And like, I knew you through all of that period and you were always really sort of thoughtful and sensitive and not really nosy, but also not kind of grossed out when I did go into it. And I think sometimes it's, you know, like when you're in the shit, you just want to have a common shared vocabulary to describe the flavor, texture and size of the shit, and that's all I really want. You know, that's what the book is hopefully doing, is giving people a bit of a common vocabulary and understanding of what quite a lot of people around them will be feeling.
I will have known you for a lot of the period that this book is, and I have to say that I've only read the introduction
best bit.
Well, you said just read the introduction, which makes me think we'll just tear the rest of the book out.
I can say that because as a journalist, I've had to interview a lot of people about a lot of things, and it's not much time to consume it all. You know, you can't keep up on someone's entire career before you chat to them. It's impossible.
I will. I'll get stuck into this.
But I'm pretty good at doing all of that, doing the reading and the research.
I thought
And then I sort of like just cut into the stuff that the show's about, which is like favourite film and what music you're into. But Nat is pretty slack when it comes to reading up on people. which is why I go very quiet during the interview sections and let Nat do most of the heavy lifting, because I like to see him squirm.
Nat, can I just go back to your thing about your parents? Yeah. My mum was 34 when she had me and I had a baby at 32, and I think there's definitely that is on your horizon, even subconsciously.
Yeah.
About like when do babies come along? And like my mum had my sister at 24. So I think for my sister, she probably had this panic at a different stage. But they're,
generationally,
you know,
that changes as well, right? Because like that kind of, like the idea of someone at 24 having a baby would feel like, oh, that feels crazy.
Yeah. The MP, Jess Phillips, she's really interesting about this because she had her children in her early 20s. And is having a really illustrious political career in her 40s, just as all of her friends are kind of locked down into early parenthood. And I think if we want to liberate women to have sensational careers and the possibility of children too, we have to slightly change the sort of panic about young women getting pregnant, because maybe young women getting pregnant is good and fine. I wasn't ready at 24, although I was bloody well trying to get people to impregnate me at 24. I was probably lucky that I waited until I did.
From my point of view, I want to be a dad, but I'm scared and I'm not sure.
Quite right, because it's absolutely fucking terrifying.
And I'm not sure when I want to. Part of me thinks that if I'd have had kids when I was 20, that, you know, I'm 40 now, there'd be 20-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And I could go back to having the life that I've got right now, thereabouts,
yeah,
and have grown-up children if I'd have done it 20 years ago, but I was scared. And now it's going to be up until when I'm 60.
What were you scared of, do you know?
I was scared that it wasn't the right time. I was scared that I didn't have enough money, that I didn't ever start making any money in this career until I was... I had lots of jobs that I hated. Mm. And then I know that my dad worked, and my mum, they worked doing... I think my mum liked her job, though, but my dad did a job that he wasn't really recognised for. He's a very creative man, right. And he did a job... he was a civil servant and he did it to make the money, and then all of his sort of like artistic things was sort of secondary.
So you were worried about losing?
And I was sort of artistic, and then by the time I started making a career out of that, I was 30 or 29, and then I hadn't made enough money to think that I could ever support a family. And it's weird because I know that when you have a family, you find a way to make it work. But
well, if you're, you know... That's if you're lucky. You know, I think the truth is that there has to be we have a welfare state because it is sometimes impossible to juggle all of that. And that is why people like us pay our taxes, so that people who are less fortunate can, you know, cope with something as sort of an earthquake through their life and career, like having a child. But the financial imperative is like massive. My partner, who was really reluctant to have children and is like dead set against the idea of having another one at the moment, a lot of that is I'm sure informed by the fact that he grew up without much money, and his, you know, it was not a struggle, but it was sort of dicey financially, and he worried that he wouldn't be able to provide. And I think that's completely legitimate, because I had to actually show him my bank statements when I wanted to take my coil out to prove that I could pay the rent for a couple of months. All things about like housing and your, you know, a word he used a lot was security. I wasn't ever really sure what that meant, because I felt very secure in our relationship. But I think he meant security sort of in terms of his career. Was this going to banjax his opportunity to do work that he loved? Because that was going to last for another 30, 40 years. And, you know, having a child, like you say, after 20 years, they sort of exit your life to a large extent, I think. And so then if you are in an unhappy job or an unhappy relationship, there's, you know, that can be devastating.
Mm. You don't, yeah, I mean, you moved out of London. So I guess whether that was because you wanted to, or whether you would you have chosen to stay in London if you could, or was that something else that you kind of go, well, this will be a bit of a sacrifice, I'll change this and I'll...
It's really weird. Should I tell you a weird thing about leaving London? Is that right now I'm looking out of my window and I can see the street that I grew up on. I've moved... Mm.
Where in London did you live and where did you move?
I lived in Clapton. I lived right by the River Lee in Clapton for 10 years. And I lived in London Fields before that. But I was born in London, and then we moved to Oxford when I was about 4. And then, yeah, so I grew up in Oxford, moved around, went to London for a large chunk of time, and then had a kid and had this sort of dilemma about where do we live. And it was weird, like the scales fell from my eyes and I thought, oh, we could actually just move to Oxford. And so now I'm looking at the street I grew up on. And so like a weird sort of recalcitrant homing pigeon, I have almost completely repeated quite major hallmarks of my own childhood. Had a baby at roughly the same time. I'm in Oxford. My partner's a teacher. My mum was a teacher. Like there's lots of similarities. But also with the added bonus that I walked past the bus stop that like I got fingered up against when I was 15 while pushing a buggy. That's nice. That's
Oh, your barber.
How? No. Even I am not going to sink that low.
Oh, I mean, well, you got a tissue out of it.
Oh, barber!
What did you think I said?
Father, which was way
God, why
worse.
Why would I say
okay,
that?
That's much better.
Why would I say that? Well, why are you father? Oh, thanks for coming on the show.
I took that very well.
She got fingered by her dad.
Oh, yes.
If you had said that and that was my response, to just sit in stunned silence and make a joke out of it, I think that's pretty good going.
If we'd have just moved on, and then forever, you would have just thought that
I know, that's
my
what
show,
I was worrying about.
And I'd have said that you got no. fingered by it.
I have a very grubby sense of humour, so I think if you'd caught me a couple of years ago, I'd have been like, ha ha. Now I think, God, man.
But it does.
Where's
it,
your sense of decorum?
In the time before that, so it went before, essentially, in the prequel to the book you haven't written yet, was it always in your head that I do want to have a baby? Or did it take you by surprise?
Bloody great question. Because I think I was incredibly maternal as a child. I was a sort of child who would march up to people at like a barn dance and physically take their baby off them and like hold it, because I loved babies so much. I loved babies in the way that people love remote control cars. I was just like, oh God, I love them. And then at 18 or 19, when I broke up with my first ever boyfriend, I was really broody. I think that's largely to do with like the loss of love makes you sort of want unconditional love. You know, I think that's fairly obvious. And then throughout my 20s, I had this sort of spider sense that wanting a baby made me fairly sexually unattractive to a lot of people. So I kept it very quiet, to the point where I think even I started to doubt whether I did. You know, I'd say to people, I mean, I don't know, like maybe, I'm not sure, you know, environmentally it's not great. And in terms of my career, I'm not sure whether I'd be ready, and I haven't met the right person. So I don't know, maybe I want to have a baby, maybe I don't. And then it was only probably around my 29th, 30th sort of time. I was going to say birthdays, but it didn't happen at my party. But when I was about 30 or turning 30 and I was in therapy, I finally dared to say out loud, I think I want a baby. And it was terrifying. It's so frightening to admit what you want. Because to admit that you want something that much and it's that important to you opens you up to the catastrophic possibility that you might not get it and you will be very, very sad. And if you don't admit that you really want something, then you don't ever have to really admit to being sad that you didn't get it. So I probably always wanted a baby. I wasn't really that clever about what having a baby would look like. But for a little while, I shied away from that because it seemed like it might not happen and I couldn't bear the disappointment. And then I had a baby and it was in a lot of ways not what I'd hoped for, and harder and stranger. And I was not like the mother I thought I'd always be. I thought I'd be this like really creative, really thoughtful, kind, generous mum. And I spent a lot of time feeling angrier than I have ever felt in my life. Maternal fury, maternal rage is... it's nuclear. It is bizarre.
At your child or on your child's behalf?
Both. He makes me feel... he will do things that like sear into my body and brain with like complete rage. Like today, I made him get off a log because I had to come back and do some work. And he was so angry that he like clawed at my face and kicked me in the stomach. And that physically I can fucking handle a 3-year-old. The idea that someone that you love will like physically attack you for doing something completely reasonable, a one-off occasion you can handle. When it happens almost every day, I think it grinds you down. And I just, or there is this sort of theory that because children aren't particularly articulate and they struggle to express and communicate their feelings, they evoke those feelings in you. So he will do, like, he's really, really angry that I'm making him get off a log. How can he communicate how angry he is? He makes me really angry, and then I understand, and I'll sort of feel sorry for him, and we can sort of repair. So there's, like, two things. Either he's a total cunt, or he's trying to let me know that I'm being a total cunt. Who knows?
And he doesn't understand the consequences of it.
Or... Yeah, yeah. And he is so secure in my adoration and affection for him that he can... Have you just seen a baby on the floor, Nick?
No, I can hear someone in my flat, and I think that's impossible.
It's my child. I've sent him to stay with you.
Come to kick me in the dick.
I thought he could have a little lockdown sabbatical with a man in his 40s. I thought that'd be nice.
I've got a collection of bobbleheads that he can play with.
Hey! No, you would never let him play with them. Come on.
No. Most of them are still in their boxes. Carry on. Sorry. I was scared for my safety. It's fine.
What was I going to say? In fact, you have finished your point. But
yeah,
I remember at that time when because I guess I knew you for some of the period of when your book is is set in. But I think almost you were too apologetic, almost. And I guess that's perhaps another thing that women have, that I remember you saying something. And I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, it almost make you look like in a bad. But I remember you saying something like, saying to me something like, this is probably why women of about 30 seem mad. And I remember going, that seems unfair. But almost like that seems like an awful thing to say. But I remember that was your kind of, you sort of had that attitude to it. It was kind of like, this is why, this is what's, but I don't know if that is necessarily my, I guess you're never talking about others' experience anyway, are you? You're talking about
yourself. I mean, it is a memoir and it does go.
Well, I thought you were mad.
Oh, right. The thing about being mad, I think I was really wrestling with that, because I think what I was trying to say was we're being made to feel like we're mad for what are actually completely rational feelings. To wonder and worry about whether your fertility is going to run out before you have made the decision is a completely rational thing to worry about. But you are sort of treated like you're being semi-hysterical if you say, oh my God, I'm single and 30. Am I ever going to have a baby? People are like, come on, love. It's not the 30s. You don't have to, you know, like you've got a lot more to your, there's a lot more to living than that. But I think maybe the being sort of overly apologetic or self-deprecating or self-critical, like I didn't make this easy for myself. You know, there are people who know for absolute certain that they never want to have children, and there are people who know for absolute certain that they do want children, and they carry that very lightly throughout their life. And it is, you know, they are happy and content, and they probably don't panic and sweat it out at weddings and birthday parties and baby showers and all those things. I have probably overthought this to an extent, but that is, you know, that's sort of your job, isn't it, as a writer, to overthink and then express what's happening around you.
In the way that our behaviour, when people, these kind of behaviourists, look at it and think, oh, well, the reason we do that is entirely based on some sort of prehistoric kind of, you know, we all, do you think a lot of it might actually be, there's actually biology that makes you feel this way as much as it's your own kind of outside influence or what you're thinking about yourself? Do you think it is that, you know, on some level, that your body is saying, come on, hurry up.
I think you can only stare into a bloody gusset so many times before you start to think, actually, how many of these have I got left? And there is, that does, for me anyway, it kicked into gear. I do also wonder, and it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on this, that I've never known a force stronger than the libido of a 30-year-old woman. Like women in their early 30s are the horniest people alive. And I do sometimes wonder if that's because there's a little bit of you that thinks, right, my fertility isn't going to last forever. If I'm going to do this, I want to do this now. And I'm not an evolutionary scientist, and I'm not a biological determinist. Like, that is just a thought that I had when I was, I mean, literally throwing myself groin first at people thinking, why am I like, what, where's this come from? Why am I so horny all the time? In a way that, like, is jokingly talked about teenage boys. But no one really jokes about horny women in their 30s, but they are as horny.
I don't think that, I think that when we're born, I don't think that when we're born, we learn 100% of all of the stuff we know. We're born with, we're born with the instincts of being a human. And I think that we fight against those instincts to some degree as people, you know. I think, I don't know, I think we're animals, aren't we, with clothes?
Yeah.
And I think that if it was kind of, if there wasn't the biological thing of women having menopause on the horizon and this ticking clock, like there is for men, men kind of like can have found a convenient way of putting off their biology. We all live into our 90s, 80s, 70s, you know, our lives are so long now in a way, you know, as we said earlier, in a way that they were never really designed to be. It's all a lot of time filling. So for women, it's just kind of like, I don't know, biologically, your eggs ran out towards the end of your life, and now it's slap bang in the middle, and there's so much more to achieve in your life after you've had the kids, you know.
Sarah Pascoe's book Animal is so interesting about that, about how our biology cannot possibly have caught up with our politics or our, you know, ideology or our civilization. We can't. Like, that's not how evolution works. So we are now in a position that our brain and bodies just really struggles to calculate. Like, you can have sex and not get pregnant, and our bodies are still a bit confused about that, because that, you know, that's only been quite a recent thing. Or yet, like you say, you can live into your 80s, and that's really quite recent in terms of human evolution. So yeah, a lot of this is probably to do with that tricky conflict between a biological instinct that we struggle to understand and a sort of a psychological principle that we struggle to define, and we're caught somewhere in between.
I sometimes wonder if it's like helpful as well. Like, it makes, like, as I'm saying, I'm sitting here going, oh God, I'm 41. I probably will be 42 when things go a bit more back to normal. I've missed a year. And then you think, would it be more helpful if it was very in that, like, almost was it better in the olden days where someone was basically telling you, oh yeah, you've got to start, you know, when everything felt a bit more, there was a bit more pressure. I mean, I guess I'm talking about men again, aren't I? But it's more like,
and I'll tell you what would be helpful in, for me personally, would be side effect free, hormone free male contraception that was like, that worked. You know, I know we've got condoms and we've got vasectomies, but they're not really, they're not quite good and they're not quite up to the job. I think if men could be in control of their reproductive ability and choices from the moment they want to be sexually active, that would have a phenomenal effect on the way we think about all of this stuff. And you know, like, what happened to vasectomies? Why do we not talk about them? Like, if you're a man who's absolutely sure you don't want to have a baby, why don't you just get a vasectomy? And then you don't have to worry about it anymore. And if you're a man who's not sure if you want to have children, then why is the onus not on you to alter either your body or your behaviour in order for that not to happen?
Why is there something in that, I mean, how did you find out about birth control and the coil, for instance, you know? Is that a thing that's passed down to you? Because I think in terms of vasectomies, it's kind of like this thing that I don't 100% know how it works. It's kind of like this mythological thing that maybe 3% of people that I know have gone for. And
it's also a punchline, right? It feels almost like a joke or a kind
of... Or really 80s. Like, it feels like a thing that... It feels like something that gets discussed in like an early Woody Allen film, but we don't really talk. It's like
we're in a car insurance advert with General Zod in it, you know. It's kind of like it's like a thing that there's a lot of it's not ever been openly, but I don't know what sex education is like in schools now, but it wasn't kind of one of the things that we were taught about.
Yeah. And again, I think it's that thing again about having men have that kind of, in their head, everyone's picturing themselves as Des O'Connor stroke Jagger. So it'd be like, oh, you know, who knows? Why would I? You've got that option. It's always that kind of, in the back of your mind, there is this funny idea of picturing these two orange men in the future. That will be like, I could be like them.
Yeah, I could just be a really varnished fat father. That'd be fine.
Ron Sealed. I could be like a Ron Sealed.
Yeah.
We're basically getting to the end of the show.
We've still got 5 minutes. We started to... No, do we? No.
We've got 2 minutes. We've got 2 minutes.
Bloody hell. Okay.
We have got a game to play with you, though, Nell.
Lovely.
Hang on a minute. Hang on, Nat.
All right.
Thanks, Nell, for talking to us.
I'd like to have you
back on because I feel like we didn't really scratch the surface. But we've come to the end of our time. Your book is out, as I said, yesterday. On the 11th of February. And I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel to play our game, Better or Worse. Nathaniel, take it away.
Now, this game is better or worse. You have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before it. Brilliant. If the score points, you have to say it's entirely from my perspective. You have to say whether I think they're better or worse to score points. So, yeah, inside my head.
Okay.
One minute.
Inside the hat of Nathaniel Metcalf. Okay.
Beginning with Lucy Liu. Is Jennifer Jason Leigh better or worse than Lucy Liu?
Better.
Really?
This is the slowest you've ever done it, Nat. This is the slowest you've ever done it.
Jason Leigh, better or worse than Jennifer Jason Leigh?
Worse.
Jason Bateman, better or worse than Jason Leigh?
Better.
Jason Momoa, better or worse than Jason Bateman?
Worse.
Better, I hope.
Worse. Jason Statham, better or worse than Jason Momoa?
Better.
Freddie Mercury, better or worse than Jason Statham?
Better.
Worse.
What?
Fred Savage, better or worse than Freddie Mercury?
Worse.
Better.
Just a genuine...
Freddy Krueger, better or worse than Fred Savage?
Oh, worse.
Better.
He's worse.
Freddy Krueger?
Michael Myers, better or worse than Freddy Krueger?
Worse.
What?
Mike Myers, better or worse than Michael Myers?
Worse.
Ooh. I'm lost. I'm going to say better.
Better.
Mike Myers is better than Michael Myers. Yeah.
Which is which?
Freddy Krueger. Mike Myers is Wayne's World. Michael Myers is Halloween.
He's a murderer.
Ah, yes.
Freddy Krueger could kill Fred Savage in his sleep.
Yeah, it doesn't make him a good person.
Yeah.
It makes him better. And that was like a pun. That was a pun as well. Like he could do it in his sleep.
You got six.
Well, you've done very averagely, I'm afraid.
All I've ever hoped for.
He's got a 6, which isn't as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Joe Scaldini with 10, David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, Matthew Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Esten, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacs and Simon West, John Art Niven, Magical Bones, Samantha Morton, Matt O'Kine, Miranda Raisin, Griff Rhys-Jones, Chris Starks, Stu Whiffen with 8, Richard Herring, James King, Ludi Lynn, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, but you're as good as Gary Delaney and Frank Harbour with 6, and better than poor old Dave McLean with 5. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you again. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with the rest of lockdown. And don't go. And we will see you sometime in the future. And listeners, thank you very much. I hope you're all safe. And tune in next week and send in your fan mail. Brilliant. Thank you very much from me.
Goodbye.